Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 98, section 6, which is old single column, page 1083. All right, as we were foreshadowing at the end of the preceding session last week, we have the final couple sections here of this paper and the whole block of papers on Melchizedek and the immediate consequences of Melchizedek with all the Melchizedek missionaries. just to remind you a little bit of how we wrapped up. You remember we went through the mystery cults and especially focused a lot on Mithraism in the Roman context. Remember how they had that final little footnote sort of paragraph to close out section 5 that was reminding us between the lines of the basics of what goes forward from that that Roman context into Christianity. You have the a large degree of Mithraism that rolls into Christianity, as I pointed out. You can kind of think of that as that element that you especially kind of openly consider in Roman Catholicism, that side of the equation there, the Christology side, the Christology side, that whole development that flies under the banner word Christ, that as we saw in so many ways, is the myth of Mithras reworked. And on the other hand, in contrast to that Christology, the other ology is Mariology, which is the immediate evolution of that long-standing Mother of God cult that goes all the way back to stemming from Cain when he left the second garden and brought forward the idea of his one divine parent, quote unquote, of Eve.
Chris, what did you say Christ meant? Was it Messiah?
Well, Christ, is the same word as Messiah. It means the anointed, right? Christ is obviously Greek, and Messiah is Hebrew. Right. Now they both mean anointed. So when you capitalize it, as capital C Christ or capital M Messiah, it's the anointed. So you've got to, remember, you literally had the temple to the Great Mother and the temple to Mithras side by side, and they could just be encompassed and merged together in budding Christianity. We'll see that when we get to the end of this next section, that issue comes back around again. Exactly how that played out compared to how it was going with when you had overt Mithraism and overt mother cult worship. Remember, we saw that in Rome that cult of the Great Mother had pretty much adopted a Mithraic like ritualistic modality, so that provided immediate sort of just simple material, mechanical context to bring them together. If you adopt that ritualistic modality in Christianity, you can bring the two together quite naturally with that. You know, just that simple kind of outer life beginning element.
The virgin birth was kind of part and parcel with this, almost necessary.
Yeah, and of course, taking it even further, not only, you know, Jesus being born of a virgin, but the virgin being born of a virgin. You know, I mean, you know, so you've got to have it, you know, very, very pure. And so, you know, all of that, you know, and it took, you know, the last 2,000 years in many ways to develop the sort of full-throated Mariology that you can have in some quarters in Roman Catholicism today. You know, they didn't put together all of those, you know, those doctrines, you know, right up front. But it's, you know, it's taken on a natural development over the last 2,000 years, and you know, it in many ways can kind of be a complete lifestyle solution in itself. As I pointed out, there's always been this tension. It's like when people in the Catholic Church start to get too much like that, they always feel some blowback from other people in Catholicism. It's like, wait a minute, aren't you kind of forgetting about Christology, right? Because obviously you can have the same tendency when you focus on the Christ to kind of not really get to God. Obviously, you've got that in parallel on the mother cult side of not really getting to God. You know, just the mother of God, right? But of course, you know, at least on the Christology side, you kind of sort of have Jesus, you know, that can maybe you can sort of unconsciously identify with a little bit in a true way to give you a little grounding in the cosmos. Yeah. But boy, you know, if you just get totally, you know, you're bounded away from God and Jesus, and, you know, now you're really in a roll-your-own sort of land. So there's always been that tension. And it's just, it's inescapable because, you know, when all is said and done, everything I just said just reminds you that even Christianity, you know, with its... you know, at least occasionally talking about Jesus, is just an evolutionary religion. Right? It's, you know, consciously, there really isn't anything that you would call genuine religion in most senses. You know, it's just that normal evolutionary religious product. It's all an outer life phenomenon. You know, for many, that Mithraic ritual, the word ritual is what, you know, the word worship means to them. Worship is just a ritual, right? It's not something at the heights of your inner life. It's not genuine worship. You know, it's barely even, you know, the feeling of that you get from the sixth adjective of reverence, right? Or some anthropomorphized veneration. I mean, it's kind of just completely external as ritual. You know, almost divorced even from feeling, let alone from genuine spiritual identification. So, right, it's just the normal, and then we saw that just like all those evolutionary religions, the same process is always in play. It just gets more and more and more complicated as time rolls on. You know, and the more wheels within wheels there are, the more our animal natures judge it to be profound. You know, and it's got to be real. I mean, look at all of the complexity here. And, you know, and look at how reverently the professionals, you know, dot every I and cross every T of all of that complexity. And it's just the way, you know, it's just the way we are. You know, so step one to either getting to genuine religion or getting to the real Jesus is to see Christianity for what it is. Right? It's not bad, but it's just merely natural, you know, mostly. It hasn't really taken that big step towards genuine religion, which is fundamentally wholly unnatural. Something that is only the product of choice predicated on eternity. Not just your natural feelings in an interplay with temporal affairs. So that, you know, that's what we're doing here. You know, as we end up this block on the Melchizedek Papers, this is to put a final period on our study of evolutionary religion. So we know what evolutionary religion is, where it fits in, you know, where its value lies in the evolutionary process. Yes, but also what it isn't. Right? That there's something more than that that humans could seek. Something besides that most sublime evolutionary product about outer life affairs. Right? Something genuinely inner. Something way beyond your feelings. You know, way deeper than your feelings. Something that starts with eternity.
Well, as it seems to point out, the path through Melchizedek, which he says, trust and faith, mm-hmm. which is the spiritual side of that.
Right, way. Right.
And then Jesus, which is love and service,
right.
which is still the spiritual side
right.
of that. Really, those are the kinds of things that really make up your own personal religion.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's not, and what you're saying to me anyway is, there are all these outer religions that you mm-hmm. belong to. But what's interesting when you read this is they kind of, you know, there's really nothing wrong with them. They just kind of have to be there because you
right.
can't get from here to here
right.
without going through those to begin with.
Right.
And we can't get from, you know, whether it's Christianity, Islam, Judaism, you know, Shintoism, whatever it is mm-hmm. today,
mm-hmm.
immediately into just personalized religion. It's mm-hmm. going to have to sort of walk its way in there. I
yeah.
think.
If you,
it's nice to have a guide.
Yeah. If you find yourself in the current age completely secularized, you know, and divorced from any evolutionary religious structure, okay, I mean, step one to getting to genuine religion is that stepping stone. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, you can't somehow just magically go from an utterly materialistic, secular state of mind to genuine religion. You need an intermediary transitional phase, you know, for your adolescence. We're going to, you know, it's actually, you know, it's appropriate that we're talking about this a little bit up front, because as soon as we read the first paragraph, we're going to have an extended discussion on some of these very issues, because they tee up again an issue that we put on hold a little bit from the end of the preceding paper. They want us to talk about some of these issues just a little bit.
Okay.
Kind of getting us all spun up, you know, into that mode, so we can hash that out a little bit. They want to carry us forward from talking just about Mithraism, and before we talk just about Christianity, to how the two, for a few centuries there, are in an interplay. You know, and it sort of just goes from, you know, the dominance of one to kind of, you know, on equal par with each other, you know, to the dominance of the other. Right? It just, you know, it just seesaws from one to the other during this transition time that we're going to be reading about here. So let's jump in and see what they've got here.
Section 6, Mithraism and Christianity. Prior to the coming of the mystery cults and Christianity, personal religion hardly developed as an independent institution in the civilized lands of North Africa and Europe. It was more of a family, city-state, political, and imperial affair. The Hellenic Greeks never evolved the centralized worship system. The ritual was local. They had no priesthood and no sacred book. Much as the Romans, their religious institutions lacked a powerful driving agency for the preservation of higher moral and spiritual values. While it is true that the institutionalization of religion has usually detracted from its spiritual quality, it is also a fact that no religion has thus far succeeded in surviving without the aid of institutional organization of some degree, greater or lesser.
Okay, so before we get into, like I said, what needs to be a little bit of an extended discussion of institutionalization, let me just highlight a couple of other key elements that they throw out in there. So notice they're about two-thirds of the way through when they're talking about how there was no driving agency for the preservation of higher moral and spiritual values. Notice that they're just saying preservation, let alone conservation, right? To not even have a preservation mode, let alone making it more living and future-oriented as conservation, so that's a big problem. And notice that, so higher moral and spiritual values. I mean, what's the difference between moral values and spiritual values? Okay, so you probably remember, because we kind of stumble upon it constantly, and that'll come up when we get into papers 99 through 103, very kind of scientifically even. Spirit is the substance that literally has a quality, you could even say when you're talking about it as a substance, a property of value. Or kind of just to be simple about it, you can say spirit is value. Okay, so that's very direct. If you're talking about moral values, you're talking about something derivative to some degree, not as immediate, direct. And the basic thing that you want to think about in contrast there is what they're wanting you to think about by putting them both there in front of you. There's and why the spiritual is second, why it's the foundational element. So when they say spiritual values, think you as an individual. Just what you possess in internal direct identification with spirit and its qualities. Okay, and how that becomes a directing framework for your mind. Under your personal guidance. And then if you think about putting that individual into relationship with a whole, that's what the word moral is talking about. So not just you as an individual, but the contrast, and say moral, that's the individual's relationship to the whole. So, like when you talk about your moral duty, you're talking about your duty to the cosmos. So, not thinking of yourself as just an island universe with some sort of internalized goodness, right? That's spiritual. But how do I fit in? How true am I? How do I fit in relationship to the whole? So that's why they're in that order, and that's why they have both of them. And you can kind of see that. Later on when they talk about, while it is true that the institutionalization of religion has usually detracted from its spiritual quality, detracted from that, more definitive, purely personal, impersonal, individual, genuine religion, right? You're very much focusing on an outer life institutionalization, right? It may have begun predicated on some inner motivation, a little spark, okay? But that's why they're saying, it's obviously going to detract from the individual, and hence that potential to really get to genuine religion, you know, as personal spiritual experience, right? And the fullness of personality has an absolute dimension. I mean, it's purely individuated. Right? There's no relativity to it at all. So that's, you know, notice that they're giving you that, and see, and how that sort of becomes the predicate, as I was hinting at, to the whole discussion about institutionalization, which they say in the first sentence there, prior to the coming of the mystery cults in Christianity, personal religion, see, that very individuated fact, hardly developed. Now, they go on and say, as an independent institution, just to remind you, okay, yes, you establish this definitive internal, in its purest sense, an island universe fact, but that's going to have fruits. It's going to manifest outward, and it's going to get socialized. There's going to be social consequences.
Especially in the family, if no one
else. Yeah. But, you know, then, you know, notice they point that out, you know, to think about. See, it was more a family, city-state, political, and imperial affair. I mean, to think about how what they mean by family there, it's a family without real individuals, per se, see? They're actual individuals, but they aren't, you know, in any conscious way real individuals who are individually bound back to eternity, so that, like, for instance, the relationship between the husband and wife can be a true relationship predicated on real individuals going across that real divide. Okay, so it's just kind of this amorphous, sort of material collective phenomenon of quote unquote family. Okay. But we obviously want, see, so you can see they're definitely wanting you to start thinking about what they're going to talk about when we get into paper 99 of what is this genuine religious thing? You know, and if I can find that real religion, right, that genuine religion, right, as an individual fact, then I can think about consequently putting it in relationship to the whole, and I have true religion, right? The same way we see we have moral and spiritual values. See, start with the real religion, and then you put it in relationship to the cosmos, and now it's a true, more than just merely real religion, it's true religion. Okay? All right, so now, before we talk about, you know, what they're saying here, you know, just remind you, I'll read it again, you know, that, you know, that what they say there at the end, it is also a fact that no religion has thus far succeeded in surviving without the aid of institutional organization of some degree, greater or lesser. And in that same mode, remember, we saw this and put it off in the moment at the end of the preceding paper. If you want to flip back, I'm going to read that whole paragraph again. That next to the last paragraph at the end of paper 97, where in the context of Judaism, they were bringing up this exact same issue. They say, the Jewish religion persisted also because of its institutions. Now, before I go on, it's like, also, what was the other thing? Well, that's two paragraphs up. You know, it said, and this religion survives because it has effectively functioned to conserve the highest values of its followers. See, so there's that conservation thing. Okay. But they're saying, okay, there's more than that. Also because of its institutions. It is difficult for religion to survive as the private practice of isolated individuals. This has ever been the error, not just, you know, boo-boo, okay, but error, right, of the religious leaders. Yeah. See, it's making it so you end up getting bounded away from the cosmos and truth. See, it's an error of the religious leaders. Seeing the evils of institutionalized religion, they seek to destroy the technique of group functioning. In place of destroying all ritual, they would do better to reform it. In this respect, Ezekiel was wiser than his contemporaries. Though he joined with them in insisting on personal moral responsibility, he also set about to establish the faithful observance of a superior and purified ritual. Okay, so see, this is fundamentally, you can see what's at hand here. We're being challenged to face evolutionary facts. Okay. And that's extremely important if you're considering what the fifth epical revelation is giving you. If you start focusing on its emphasis that, okay, genuine religion is this personal spiritual experience, it's a purely inner life fact, no outer life at all, etc. Okay, yes, but don't forget that the main evolutionary stream is a long way from such a purely internalized mode in the depths of light and life. Okay. We can't hold on to something in this primitive, relatively primitive stage without having some external, tangible grounding of what's going on inside to kind of keep it going. Right? No matter how much we try to just go on visualization, it's going to get fuzzy and it's going to slip through our fingers. So we need to ground it as part of the main evolutionary stream. Now, again, just as an aside, each of us as individuals, if we have quite a bit of internal strength, spiritual strength, we can establish this and hold on to it relatively without external crutch. But even, you know, between the lines of what they're saying here, right, is that don't be delusional about that. None of us are that advanced. Right? We're all going to need some external literalization kind of to lean upon and to, you know, to have that mutual edification process of its socialization to kind of feed back and keep it strong within us as an individual. Don't go off, sequester yourself in a convent, right? You need that interplay. Yeah. And but you're definitely wanting to strive to do what Jesus said, okay? Discover that the basis for what you call religion is apart from others. In some ways, it's even, its predicate is apart from yourself. It's transcendent of yourself, right? It's based in eternity, whereas you're a temporal creature, right? Discover that. Seek first that. What you find there will be a dynamic fact. The fruits are automatic. It'll flow out, and you can... you can bring that into a socialized setting, even an institutionalized setting, right? So that it's an ongoing phenomenon, right? In a very outer life material existence that we inescapably are part of. So just, let's pause my own thoughts there for a second. I want to give all of you a chance to, because I'm sure you have some thoughts you want to chime in about institutionalized religion here and how that relates to the revelation and stuff too. Probably particularly that guy right there.
Oh, yeah. It's funny. When I go to church, and I'm around people who are religious, and basically before I got into your answer book, but even now, my experience in church is a one-on-one with God. It's not really nothing to do with anybody sitting around me at all. Mm-hmm. I'm aware that they're there. But now I also have this understanding that we're all part of the whole, and we're all in this together, and that no man's an island, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's real value in communicating with one another, because that's the only way you really get to know to love one another. And if you don't experience loving one another, and experience mercy and experience service and those kind of things. You can't do that with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do that by, you know, taking, you know, with other people. I mean, yeah, you can do it with animals to some degree, but I mean with other people. So you mm-hmm. have a mutual relationship. And I think, you know, I think of, you know, in the core finality, there's 1,000 of us, mostly ex-humans of one kind, mm-hmm. some other, and they're kind of, you know, put together for a long period of time after they graduate the class, and they go to all the different universes.
Yeah.
Right?
Together for a long time is an understatement.
Right.
So, let's think trillions of years.
Well, yeah. And I'm sure cores work with cores, you know, so yeah. they get to meet other people. But,
yeah.
you know, there's that whole thing of, you know, first living with 10 people and then 100 people and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that you do the socialization of religion, so to speak, seems to me to be a part of the whole plan.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just the individual side, you know, but your relationship with God, which you point out many times, is that individual relationship that only I have with my Heavenly Father. It's just something that I have,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right.
I hope He hears me.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And I hope I hear Him is more the better way to say it.
Yeah.
But it's...
Yeah, and what you're talking about right there, of course, is what they mean when they say personal religion hardly developed as an independent institution. And, I mean, they're talking about an institution where the individuals participating in it, in its structures fundamentally stand on their own in relationship to eternity and the Universal Father. But then there's fruits of that existential predicate that flow out into an experiential collective phenomenon. Yeah. And you mean another thing to bring in, you know, when you're talking up front, when we were foreshadowing this, you brought up the third epical revelation with trust and faith, and the fourth with love and service. And, you know, there's an element to what we're talking about here there as well, because people have been talking about trust and faith and love and service for a very, very long time. But we want to get to the point where, behold, all things, including those what you think of when you hear those four words, become new. Right? And it begins with the most existential, if you will, elements of those. Faith on the one hand and love on the other. Right? To get to not what the dictionary says the word faith means, or even, you know, the best is you can squeeze out of the New Testament, right, through Paul or whatnot. No, I mean, something transcendent of all of that kind of groping in the dark, and to get a profound inner recognition of what that word is meant to be applied to, something way transcendent of belief itself. It's not some flavor of belief in terms of the substance of faith. Faith, genuine faith, casts a shadow down into belief, yes, but that's the shadow's not the substance. And, you know, to find faith anew, genuine faith, so that you can get what Machiavelli was actually talking about. You know, he wasn't saying trust and faith for faith is defined as credulous belief. Right? That isn't what he was fostering. He was because that credulous belief isn't considered in and of itself unto God righteousness. Okay? Genuine faith is real faith. And then the same way with love. Right? To go way above the lower domain, you know, first and second level of meaning, you know, on what that word indicates, something way transcendent of merely a feeling, you know, not something that you really, in and of itself, would never think of using, a word like admiration for. No, love, in and of itself, right, as a personal realization of divine fellowship, something that is founded on the sixth level of meaning, right, and you know, if you find those, I mean, then what kind of trust are you talking about when it's predicated on that genuine faith? What kind of service are you talking about when it flows down and out from that kind of genuine love? Right? A kind of service that is really unknown. Right? There's some very reverent, sentimental, feelingful service out there. Right? But genuine loving service, right, is the first of that list of cosmic fruits of the Spirit. Not consciously, right? By grace, sure. You know, we play with the shadow of the real. But to have it consciously, you know, to have a hold of the substance, not the shadow, right? So that there's a conscious predicate behind your service, right? So, something that is, you would never even remotely call sentimental service. Right? Something that's not reactionary. Right? Sentimental service, no matter how reverential, is reactionary service. How about actionary service? Right? Something that originates in you, has nothing to do with seeing some issue and reacting to it. Bob hungry, you know, feed Bob. Bob naked, clothe Bob. Something that's not reactionary. Something that, you know, is originating in you as a genuine action, right? That's going to be what's going on with loving service.
You know, some of what you're bringing out is the idea of how poor we are at recognizing it, because in the first place, you're having to grope with negative examples,
right?
In order to just get.
Yeah.
Pair away some ideas in terms of thinking about that.
Like calling it not finite, infinite, you know? Instead of right. calling it something positive, you call it not finite.
Right, exactly.
Right, that same sort of thing.
And so, I mean, the same thing with your original question about institutions, you know, especially with this group. I mean, many of us, you know, we're part of institutions, and part of our finding the revelation was feeling like we outgrew the institution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether we truly outgrew the institution or not,
sure.
You know, there were still things to be gained if we'd been a little more creative.
Yeah.
But in order to get to the next stage, we had to say, that's enough of that.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And move on to
wander in the wilderness a while.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But there is that problem there. And then, having said that, again, it's the problem of recognition. It's like they talk about Ezekiel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, are we imagining what Ezekiel did? They probably describe a few things that he did in the Bible, or they wouldn't.
Right, they do. You can go there and see all the details of how he tried to improve the rituals and stuff. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, are we supposed to do exactly what Ezekiel did? Obviously not.
No.
But what are we to do? And that's the difficult thing, because in our creativity, there's a lot of our own stereotypes, prejudices, and whatnot that'll get in the way of that. So it really raises the question, how much can we get out of our own way and allow God and our relationship with God to inform some of that and be willing to make mistakes with it as well?
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. The difficult thing is being willing to make mistakes along the way and being willing to do it with other people. Now, how tolerant can you be of your fellows making mistakes around you?
Yeah.
Not very tolerant.
It's very difficult, and especially these days, in a polarized environment.
Yeah, and you know, and just, you know, when you talked about, you know, you're bringing your creativity into play, you know, and struggling to get out of the old wineskins, out of the stereotypes, and of course, the degree to which you don't succeed in getting out of the old stereotypes, it isn't really creativity. It's just inventiveness, cleverness. You know, it's not a genuinely original creativity, right? It's just a clever new way to do the old thing, and maybe, you know, so clever that it's a clever species of self-deception where you've convinced yourself you're doing something new, right? Really, you're just doing the same old routine. You know, like we saw with, instead of instead of calling him Mithras, let's call him Jesus, but let's just keep all of our old rituals and sentences, you know, concepts, you know. Right. I mean, it's just clever, right, in many ways. I mean, they cleverly kludged him into, you know, kind of the essence of Mithraism. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's, and again, I'll just, you know, maybe we'll kind of leave it there unless we want to. So someone's burning to bring in another element, but just let me just remind everyone that you have to if you're a reader of the fifth epical revelation, you one of the first things you have to kind of decide up front once this revelation sort of spins you up and gets you excited, it's like, okay, where do I see myself fitting into the greater world? I mean, do I really see myself as potentially playing a role in like we were reading there, in about Ezekiel and stuff, of reforming? Am I going to be an influence that can very effectively engage the main evolutionary stream and be a reforming influence? Maybe not, Martin Luther grade reformation, but a reforming influence. Is that where I see myself fitting? Or do you say, nah, that's just not me? I don't think I really have the kind of a bit innate abilities. I couldn't really develop into a sophisticated skill that I could. That's just not me. I think really I need to kind of more step out and just find the courage to mostly stand apart in that parallel stream. Maybe not really have much in the way of a participation in some institutionalized phenomenon or whatnot, but just kind of have it on my own. Maybe it's something I can share in a family unit, but beyond that, no. Maybe that family unit is just a significant other. You have to kind of decide that, so that you don't go on and on and on with this unresolved tension. It's like, plant yourself firmly, in one place or the other, and don't try to, sit on the fence between the two.
Yeah. I joined a church just not too long after I just started reading the Urantia book. And it was, for me, it was more not to find God, but to socialize felt it was could be important to socialize my faith, to try to share my faith with other people, and I just thought that would be an obvious place to do it. But whether I've done that well or poorly, somebody else can be the judge. But when I look at it, where things are right now, my relationship to the church is largely one of duty.
Mm-hmm. Right. First miler, duty.
But when I look out at my fellow Christians in the church, that's their relationship too.
Right.
I'm right in there.
Compulsion, duty, or convention, right.
We're in there together.
Right. First miler stuff.
And when I look at the aspirations of the church, I see all kinds of issues, all kinds of real trouble, and mostly because it's focused externally and on the problems of the world
without an internal predicate.
And if they would reflect a little bit, like even someone like Martin Luther King, who I just worshipped at a black church a week ago, and he was a true leader. But he wasn't a religious leader. He was a social leader. He was a pastor, but he stepped out of that role to lead the civil rights movement. And religion doesn't lead us. Institutionalized religion isn't the lead. It adjusts to the changed conditions of society.
Yeah, like remember how we pointed out that evolutionary religion really distills out of the mori system as, you know, the cult nucleus of a culture.
But the fervor that's out there in institutionalized religion right now, they imagine themselves that they have to be the leaders, and so they look out on society and see all the issues, and they want to have, not individually go out and work in society,
but collectively.
But collectively, yeah. as an institution,
yeah.
The church has to do this,
right.
And this is especially problematic with church leaders,
yeah.
Because. Right. Yeah, they think they have to lead the church into going out and correcting all the social justice issues in society.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
It's not going to work well either for society,
yeah,
or for the church.
And the moment you step out of that context, material gravity is just going to pull everyone down again. I mean, you know, that religious leader is supposed to be the individual that's giving everyone little booster shots, reminding them, you need to choose that which is purely internal and unnatural, so that spirit gravity can continue to lift you up inside. Because the more you go out in service, the more you're going to feel material gravity, and it's going to drag you down. You know, and so, you know, if you don't have much of an inner spirit gravity predicate, you know, it'll just take a couple short years, and you'll be just totally awash and not contributing anything lastingly helpful to that outer life, because you're just a reflection of it, right?
And I've seen this. Someone come into the church, and they've recently just discovered a new religious consciousness
right.
within themselves,
right.
And they're juiced.
Yeah, know? Yep.
And the church, you know, oh, look at this! You know, they embrace them and they give them work to do and tasks to do, and boy. It's not even 6 months, and they're burned out. You know,
yeah.
they're gone,
right.
Out of self-preservation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, they just become a cog in a mechanistic, you know, phenomenon.
Was that like the Mother Teresa of Calcutta?
Yeah, like we talk about a lot of times. You know that. You know, she ended up giving us a great gift. You know, in how honestly she disclosed her experiences, you know, when she started out cloistered with a lot of inner sense of closeness to God, and one day decided to open the window and look out, and immediately started feeling material gravity pulling her out there. Like, look at these poor, you know, starving, you know, struggling people, dying people. Yeah, we should serve. But she got so out there, you know, that she had to admit that the longer she went on with her ministry, the farther she felt from God. You know, until towards the end, she kind of decided that God had just abandoned her. Maybe her whole ministry was, falsely formed or something. I mean, it's like, no. Yeah, Teresa. I mean, it's just material gravity. I mean, that's what happens naturally. You get so focused on the outside, you know, and the more it just becomes this reactionary phenomenon. It's just a material game that you're playing, rearranging molecules. You know, and yes, you do need to rearrange molecules, but you want to do them with an eternity predicate, so that there's some point to it, right? There's a purposing that's going into it. It isn't just molecule arrangement for the sake of molecule arrangement, right? Change for the sake of change. I mean, you know, like we've talked about a number of times, I mean, death, one of the reasons death exists is to try to remind us of this, you know, that you can rearrange molecules until you're blue in the face inside of someone's body and they still die. Right, there's no way to stop them from eventually dying. You can even have a creator being, you know, direct the rearranging of the molecules in someone's body, and he still dies. He even dies of the same thing he died of initially, you know, poor Lazarus. Right. I mean, you know, death is supposed to try to remind you that, you know, you're not going to find a satisfaction for that inner flame that, you know, that you discover one day, you know, by just rearranging things out there. You need to somehow attempt to get a hold of and hold on to, maintain a bounding back, you know, a religion, a binding back to eternity. And that gets injected into the way you rearrange molecules. You don't just arrange them in a reactionary fashion based upon what's in front of you, right? You have this very transcendent long-term view, right? You rearrange things not because you want to see some consequence in your lifetime. You rearrange them so that 50 generations hence, right, your arranging was an initial predicate to what will happen way then. Right.
My favorite parable. The parable of the sower.
Right. I mean, that having, you know, eternalizing your thoughts about service. Okay, we probably ought to keep chugging along here.
You want to hear from Winston on that point?
Oh, okay, yeah.
That's a question here.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that we should not be so illogical to throw out church? I think you kind of broached it. As in the baby with the bathwater.
Yeah. That's what I was saying. I mean, in general, all right, we're, you know, those that find the Arantia book, don't get sucked into that thinking, like they were just saying, you know, that there was that big error, right, of trying to drag people out of their churches and, you know, divorce them from that socialized, institutionalized phenomenon. Most of our lives here is supposed to be a part of the collective external process. The supreme is dependent upon a lot of your life here being that. Right? There's plenty of time down the road when you've kind of done what you need to do for the sake of the whole, for the evolution of the supreme, for you to have more individual meaning, right, that is separated from the supreme, right? The drop of water separating itself from the ocean. Got it. You know, endless cycles of eternity for that. You even got trillions of years in the finite for that, right? We need to be accepting. We need to be content, not satisfied. You know, don't eternalize it, if you will. Right? But you need to be content with, you know, a lot of what you're supposed to do here in this life is a very external thing. The supreme needs that, because what's external for you is internal for the supreme, right? Your inside is his. I mean, your outside is his eventual inside. So, you just don't want to get, you know, in these dichotomy modes, you know, like we so often tend to do. When someone says personal, it's like, okay, well then I completely reject all religion, especially institutionalized. And I mean, don't be so simplistic, you know, like that.
Yeah, probably. Of all the influences I might have had, I probably had zero influence on the institution itself.
Yeah. Like we were talking about last week when we were really thinking about how vast, how much inertia there is, you know, in the Christian institution. You know, even in a subset of it, like, say, the Roman Catholic institution. I mean, you know, to think that you're just going to snap your fingers, you know, and completely change that tomorrow, I mean, you know, there's delusion, and then there's, okay, I think we call that crazy, right? That's just not going to happen, you know, any more than four prior epical revelations have completely turned evolutionary religion at a right angle. No. I mean, even the Creator Son incarnate just caused a slight deflection, you know, in the line of evolutionary religion. How much do you think you're going to bend the curve if you throw your body into it? I mean, seriously, it's got a lot of inertia.
A lot like saves us from the ice.
Yeah.
It's comforting in a way.
Yes. Okay, so that's this whole great big predicate where they want you to kind of think about institutionalized religion and stuff. And okay, meanwhile, back to Mithraism and Christianity starting to interplay.
Occidental religion thus languished until the days of the skeptics, cynics, Epicureans, and Stoics. But most important of all, until the times of the great contest between Mithraism and Paul's new religion of Christianity.
Okay, so what are they talking about there in terms of the time span? Just to keep it really simple, like I tend to do because I can't do anything else, when they're saying until the days of the skeptics, cynics, Epicureans, and Stoics, basically think post-Hellenic, remember they mentioned Hellenic Greeks, right, in the preceding paragraph. So think the three century, you can think of three key centuries of Hellenized civilization. Not Hellenic, but Hellenized, right? Post-Alexander the Great, in other words, right? So, the 3rd, 2nd, and 1st centuries B.C. That's basically what they're wanting you to think with, those philosophies, Greek philosophies of living. Okay, and then you've got the 1st century A.D., the century of the 4th epical revelation. So that stands on its own, as a singular century. And then that's followed by 3 centuries that you could call the formation of the Christian church. The 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries A.D. Okay, that's what they're referring to, most fundamentally, when they say, until the times of the great contest between Mithraism and Paul's new religion of Christianity. Okay. The 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries A.D. Okay. So, see, we're just sweeping through those times. You'll see that very directly as we go to the next paragraph.
During the 3rd century after Christ, Mithraic and Christian churches were very similar, both in appearance and in the character of their ritual. A majority of such places of worship were underground, and both contained altars, whose backgrounds variously depicted the sufferings of the Savior who had brought salvation to a sin-cursed human race.
So you notice in this paragraph and the next, they're going to give us a little bit more of what they did in the preceding section of, that's where Christianity got that, right? I mean, just yet more stuff that was just brought right over from Mithraism, the basic aspect of it. And you just tweak the details to change it from Mithras to Jesus.
Why were they underground?
Remember it started with the grotto, phenomenon.
Being persecuted?
Initially, there's reasons, for the Christians because of persecution, but there's also the tradition of, coming from the mystery cults, too. So, see, it's a mixture of both.
Oh, that was traditionally
under? Yeah. Because, again, it's just, you go into the grotto and there's even one element of going into the grotto just reminds you a little bit of the whole concept going to the underworld and coming back. It's just reminding you of that whole salvation modality that you're playing with. Not to mention, like I said, just the delights of doing orgiastic rituals, with torchlight dancing off of a cave and down in a cave. Right? It's all just part of the whole scheme.
Many American Indians have a similar tradition.
Look at how Cro-Magnon was, doing that sort of stuff. I mean, this goes way back. Okay. But notice what they said during the 3rd century. So like I said, you've got three centuries that you're really thinking of, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries A.D. So, you know, you can just picture it. In the 2nd century, you have, you know, Mithraism dominating. You get to the middle of those three, and they're kind of, right, equal magnitude, neck and neck, see, like they're describing there, right? Very similar. And then, of course, as we all know, in the 4th century, that's when Christianity, you know, becomes dominant, you know, and eventually, you know, I mean, it's adopted as the religion of the Roman Empire and everything, right, in the 4th century. Council of Nicaea and all that sort of stuff.
And they became intolerant.
Right? See, so you just literally have this three centuries, you know, beginning, middle, end, you know, and one dominating, they're about this equal, and then the other dominates. And it just switches from one to the other. You know, and as it, because it does it so just handing off like that, that's why all of this stuff got handed off. I mean, just almost nothing was left behind. I mean, they took basically every element of Mithraism and reworked it in some way. So and because Mithraism had a long tradition, they didn't have to really invent much of anything, just cleverly rework everything, and they've got the complete lifestyle solution in terms of all the rituals and whatnot. Okay.
Always had it been the practice of Mithraic worshippers, on entering the temple, to dip their fingers in holy water. And since in some districts there were those who at one time belonged to both religions, they introduced this custom into the majority of the Christian churches in the vicinity of Rome. Both religions employed baptism and partook of the sacrament of bread and wine. The one great difference between Mithraism in Christianity, aside from the characters of Mithras and Jesus, was that the one encouraged militarism while the other was ultra-pacific. Mithraism's tolerance for other religions, except later Christianity, led to its final undoing. But the deciding factor in the struggle between the two was the admission of women into the full fellowship of the Christian faith.
You know, because so you see it there at the end, like I was telling you, we get back to that. That ended up being very key. You didn't have any sort of kind of separate but equal, the side by side temples. That you crammed them together. You know, there's, like I said, there's tensions, right? Because it's kind of a heterogeneous, not a homogeneous mixing, but. But nonetheless, because you've forced them under one roof, that was a deciding factor. Because remember, what is the foundation of all human institutions, religious or otherwise? Family, right? You're never going to build as enduring an institution if you if the institutionalization, is. Basically antithetical to family. Two secret societies. I mean, no, it needs to come together. Because when you've got the family under the one roof, the nuclear integrity of a family helps to establish an ongoing integrity for the institution. Okay, so that was key, and just notice the Mithraists are more tolerant than the early Christians, but that's their undoing. See, so again, when you think about things like tolerance, it's like, well, okay, there's a place for some intolerance in the evolutionary process. This is a very tricky thing. You can't be very purist about all these things. On the one hand, you need to be tolerant society, and on the other hand, it's like, no. I mean, this institution can only endure if it has bounds. If you just throw the bounds off of it, it's not going to endure. You're not going to have everyone, I'm sure, is thinking, the obvious thing that's going on, a lot in the, these days in our discussions, you're not going to have an enduring nation that doesn't have borders. For instance, right? You can't just think, you know, everyone's born equal and we just, you know, it's six of one, half a dozen another. No, it's like you've got a nation that's predicated on a certain internal consistency of some sort. It might be merely racial or whatever, but it's some sort of internal. You know, and the only way you're going to keep that going is if you maintain that relative independence. You can't just wash it and everything else.
Their wording of that I find very curious. Because mm-hmm. they was one encouraged militarism while the other was ultra-Pacific. Which is which? They didn't spell it out. They made you figure it out.
Yeah, and just see all the delightful things that you can think about, the tensions there. It's like, well, obviously ultra-Pacific is better. It's like, well, yes and no. I mean, see, again, like war is one of the indispensables in the early progress of civilization. All this stuff, it's a complicated thing about what, what's good in an evolutionary sense, because it's part of a perfecting process, as opposed to what's good in an existential sense. So anyway, yeah, all that is kind of playing in there.
Probably a place and a time for each.
Place and a time, you know. But then, you know, you find the place and the time for something, and all good things taken to extreme become bad, you know. And so there's a time when it has to, you know, be let go of, too.
Chris?
Yep.
What is ultra-Pacific?
Pacifists, you know.
Oh, okay.
It's not salt water.
Why do they call it the Pacific Ocean? Yes.
Because of typhoons.
Okay. But just, you know, the really fascinating bottom line there, you know, besides, you know, like I said, giving you more about baptism, you know, and the sacrament of bread and water and all those sorts of things that, you know, they just got rolled over into Christianity. The fact that, you know, that men and women together is important, you know, and you can also remind yourself, it's important to get women in there, especially when we're all kind of just so natural still. I mean, women are naturally placed. I mean, I'll bet an enduring institution is facilitated by some degree of place likeness in play, as opposed to a bunch of people that are just flying off in random directions. I mean, how's that institution going to stay together? I mean, there's got to be some very place-like individuals. Yeah. We all know that an awful lot of mainline churches, you know, even non-mainline churches, have been held together for centuries by the ladies of the church. Okay. You know, or Bob doesn't go to church anymore, but his wife does, you know. All those sorts of things. That are so natural, they're cliches, right? Yeah, and then there's coincidentally, you can also get away from Bob. So it all works out, yeah. Yes. As if the evolutionary process doesn't know all these things and coincidentally makes it all work. Anyway, that's another key thing we'll want to think about as we go forward into 99 through 103, you know, papers 99 through 103, is don't forget about all institutions have that family predicate. Right?
In the end, the nominal Christian faith dominated the Occident. Greek philosophy supplied the concepts of ethical value. Mithraism, the ritual of worship observance, and Christianity as such, the technique for the conservation of moral and social values.
Notice I did say conservation there, instead of preservation, merely preservation. But also notice moral and social values. Notice the difference from before. It's like, oh, okay, so now we're kind of moral in quotes, right? What are we talking about when we're saying moral and social values? Okay, now we're basically talking about the mores system, right? Social values is, you know, going to go with the mores system proper, and the taboo elements in it are the quote-unquote moral things, right? Right. So, yeah, you know, this isn't a pedantically constructed book, right? I mean, they're not going to always put quotes around it, you know, if it really isn't quotes. But speaking of kind of putting quotes around it, notice that they said nominal Christian faith, and they said, and Christianity as such.
Yeah.
Okay. They put quotes around it twice, right? You know, why are they doing that? You know, we're going to get into that more precisely in the next section. But, I mean, they're obviously saying, okay, what about that Christ word? Yeah, okay, the name is there, nominal, right? The name is there. But, you know, what do you really, what are the details of this Christ concept that you've constructed? Is this, like I was saying up front, is this the, you know, basically a Christology that is reworked Mithraism? So that, you know, that's kind of what you mean by Christ is just the new and improved Mithras? Right. Throw in a little bit of Jewish Messiah stuff, you know, and maybe, and you know, and ta-da. Yeah.
What they're talking about there, though, is faith. Faith is both nominal and Christian.
Yes, right, so, right. I hadn't gotten to that yet. Okay. Just, you know, I was just pointing out, yeah, and then there's that, you know, I already talked about that before. What about the faith word? Yeah. You know, a lot of people give lip service to those two words, Christian faith. Okay, but have they really reflected on either word? How much is either word true? Right. You know, and it just becomes a pleasing a little bit of virtue signaling that you can toss out there. I have Christian faith. Ooh. Right? That's impressive. It's like, well, okay. I mean, yeah, don't misunderstand me here. I'm not being utterly dismissive, but right, again, that's the whole contrast between there's the evolutionary stuff and then there's what you can challenge yourself to begin to try to find amidst all of that evolutionary confusion that the revelation is talking about. You know, taking the quotes off of these words like religion and worship and faith and spirit and et cetera, personality. And let me finish first.
Christianity is a different word. There's Mithraism.
Yeah.
It's an ism. Christianity is a slightly different, it's a different word. It's not.
Yeah. Yes.
Christism,
right? Yeah, like we talked about, you know. I mean, it isn't just, you know, a Jesusism or even a Christism, you know, in a pure sense, right? I mean, it is sort of the most sophisticated construct, right?
That evolutionary,
yeah. That is actually kind of pushing a little bit beyond a mere ism, right? That's why it's so sad if someone gets the fifth epical revelation and just goes backward and says, you know, we really need to put the ism back in Jesus-ism. You know? Right? It's like, no. At least we got to an ITY suffix with Christianity. It's like I said, it's based upon, see, notice it's Christology, you know, Christ. Ology, you know, in a full sense, the logic of Christ, because, right? Like, you know, we all know how much sort of Greek mentality is coming in there. See, so again, why is it called Christianity, whereas Buddhism is called Buddhism? Yeah. Right? It's just things to think about. All right, let's I forgot. Now back to John. Yeah, sorry.
So you mentioned quotes a minute ago, and I forgot to ask this. Mm-hmm. In the beginning of this particular chapter, it talks about sacred book, and it's in quotes.
Oh yes,
and,
right.
And
yes.
When I read that, first of all, you know, it kind of said to me, you know, almost every religion I can think of has a sacred book.
Yeah, by quotes they mean something that they call a sacred book.
That's still. So yeah. My thinking is that, you know, here we have another sacred book.
Potentially.
So
potentially. Right.
My thought is that, well, if you follow evolution and an evolutionary path, not going too fast,
right.
I mean, it seems logical that this would end up being another sacred book.
Obviously. Obviously, it's going to have that tendency, yes. If you toss this into the main evolutionary stream, you can't prevent it from becoming a sacred book. No matter how much it says internally it isn't, how much you stand on the soapbox and scream it isn't, it'll become one.
It's a sacred book and a devil book. Both. It'll be both.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Those who don't think of it as a sacred book will think of it as a demonic text. Yes. Right. An anti-sacred book. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. I mean, that's just inescapable. And again, see, that's another thing to think about. It's like, well, if I want to really be a positive influence on the evolutionary stream, does the evolutionary stream need yet another sacred book?
Maybe the way it has to go for a while.
Maybe, but you know, see, but you can ask yourself that. Well, maybe I should try to take the faith of Jesus out there,
yeah,
not the book, right? Like I was talking about last week. I mean, because after all, especially if you really see your mission in life to try to do what the apostles didn't do and really evangelize the genuine fourth epical revelation and not Paul's Christianity.
But you've got it right here.
Right, so
you don't have
like I said, Jesus did not say, write down what I'm saying and go out and beat people over the head with the parchments. He didn't say that. Okay, so, yeah. It's much more complicated when you're talking about the fifth epical revelation. But to really give the world what it didn't get from the fourth, right, the book may get you properly focused on the real fourth, and maybe you can actually find faith without quotes for the first time. Okay, and if you do, that real faith will have fruits. Go out in the world and bestow those fruits upon the world. And you will have an impact. Real faith out there would be magnificent.
I think they even say, what a transcendent service if...
Yeah.
This revelation.
I mean, like I've said, I mean, don't underestimate how much we still need the third epical revelation.
It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, of course.
This takes out
of course. Yeah. I mean, good luck. Good luck hiding it. You know, it's all over the internet. Yeah. I mean, and you can try to institutionalize and make laws that you can't take this and use it to form some sacred book cult. It's going to happen. You're not going to stop that.
And they did decide to give us a text form of a revelation.
And they did. See, it's almost like a... Yeah,
but they put a disclaimer in.
They did.
If you study it.
Yeah, if you study it.
You're not trying to.
Right. Yeah, if you study it.
But the other side of it is, to your point earlier, we can't fear the evolutionary stream either.
No.
That the evolutionary stream is what Jesus came.
Yeah.
To experience.
To uplift, yes, and to experience, yes.
To uplift and experience.
Yeah.
And
yes, both sides.
There's no supremacy. In the capital S supremacy, without Jesus having had all those experiences.
Absolutely.
And having incorporated that in his being and understanding and being able to see both ways. As a case in point, the way this is spreading, the way the revelation is spreading internationally is very different than the way it is spreading here in North America, which is to say, it's not spreading here in North America.
Right.
It's spreading in Latin America. Right. It's spreading in the Philippines. And why? Because the families are more stable. That's one reason.
Mm-hmm.
People are willing to talk about it. People are willing to associate it with their other beliefs. And they're doing that. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, it's more organically spreading.
Yeah.
Now, there may be problems with that, but there are people younger than us studying the revelation in Latin America and in the Philippines.
Yeah. And it's going to do. It's going to go somewhere, right? And North America can try to control that, but that's silly. Right?
I think North America is going to go along. The wise ones, anyway.
Some will be drug along, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like so much of the residual Christian church, you know, tends to get drug along by the third world, you know. Okay. You know, as well. So, yeah. I mean, we want to.
Succeeds like success.
Yeah. So, like I said, there's just. We're always in this tension between. Talking about what the main evolutionary stream is going to do and what it needs and whatnot, and you know, and then there's just, you know, what Machiavelli Melchizedek didn't do with Abraham, what he did with the Kenites in that parallel stream, right? And that didn't get writ large in history, right? It wasn't successful, right, in that sort of sense, like that which flowed from Abraham was. But boy, it made an impact. You go forward a few centuries, and out of that parallel stream comes Moses to lead the main evolutionary stream. Mm-hmm. That parallel stream is sort of silent in historical records occasionally appears on the recorded stage, you know, as a leader, someone who has the big picture. The fifth epical revelation has massive potential to supply that parallel stream, besides what it could do for the main evolutionary stream.
It does that.
Yeah.
Suddenly, something.
All right. Okay. So, meanwhile, let's see what they have to say about the Christian religion here.
Section 7, the Christian religion. A creator son did not incarnate in the likeness of mortal flesh and bestow himself upon the humanity of Urantia to reconcile an angry God, but rather to win all mankind to the recognition of the Father's love and to the realization of their sonship with God. After all, even the great advocate of the atonement doctrine realized something of this truth, for he declared that, quote, God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself.
We all know who that great advocate is, don't we?
That's what
we that would be the Apostle Paul, of course. I'm quoting from 2 Corinthians there. Okay, so notice what they're doing there. It's a great example of something they do a lot in the book where they challenge you to not just approach something straightforward factually, but to think about the truth that's flowing through something. So on the one hand, when they start out, okay, it wasn't, you know, to, you know, bestow himself upon the humanity of Urantia to reconcile an angry God, where by reconcile there, you mean make friendly again, right? I mean, that kind of simplistic reconcile, right? Got an angry God, you want to make him friendly again. And remember, we've talked about this, that, you know, how all of those technical terms in religion that start with R-E, you know, like reconcile there, you know, the back sense of that R-E prefix, it's really thinking kind of going back in time. It's like, things fell apart, he's angry, now let's go back in time to before he was angry, right? You know, so he's friendly again. It's a very temporal mentality about all those R-E prefixes. But then notice what they do after that. You know, but rather, to win all mankind to the recognition of the Father, an R-E prefix. Only now, it's not back in time, effectively, that R-E. It's back to eternity. Right? It's back to the cosmos. It's like religion. You know, back to eternity. You know, most specifically, this is a, you know, kind of back to the cosmos. It's, you know, recognition is when you go back to the context of the whole and examine the part from the top down, right? Instead of looking at it from the bottom up, cognition, right? You look at it from the top down, recognition, right? You know, the whole to the part, instead of the part and never getting to the whole, right? So that, you know, that more objective, you know, use of RE, recognition of the Father's love and the realization of their sonship with God. You know, we're going beyond recognition to realization, where, you know, you're literally realityizing by bringing your spirit pattern, your personality, you know, into play and imprinting with that pattern, if you will. Realityizing this in your mind. But then they say, okay, that reconcile thing, you know, instead of just doing it in that simplistic making friendly again, we could think about the word more literally. What does, you know, reconcile mean? Right? It means where you're going back to it being together, right? To conciliate, you know, is to call together. So you're going back to when you're called together. And they're saying, so think about that. See, God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself in the sense of recognition of the Father's love and the realization of their sonship with God, right? You know, that he's trying to call us back together, right, as a collective sonship relative to his fatherhood. Yeah. So, yes, there's a truth flowing through Paul's words, even if he's kind of consciously, factually, you know, in an atonement mode, okay? you know, in a debt mode instead of a gift mode, right? But see, you can, but if you can just rise above it a little bit, it's like, well, there's the beginnings of the recognition of the gift mode by grace, right? We're sons of the universal Father, right? And we can call ourselves back together upon that predicate. So that's just a simple little example of, you know, of showing you how you can be part of an evolutionary process, but a more objective one, where you're going to rework things too. You don't have to sort of reject the word reconcile. Right? The Urantia book uses all kinds of words that are fraught with problems. But literally or in their essence, you can get back to the truth of them. Right? You don't have to coin a whole bunch of new words. Just see it anew. Behold, all those old words are becoming new.
He's kind of saying that Paul's faith was greater than his preachment.
Yeah, remember, there's, you know, I mean, Paul... You know, I mean, you know, he was engaged some, you know, so there was a little bit more to Paul than meets the eye, right? I mean, he had some recognitions tied to the imagined worlds and stuff, you know, of Marantia bodies and, you know, a lot of things, you know, that are blended into his evolutionary ignorance, right? So if you parse through it, you know, there's little glimmers of recognition that he was playing with.
It is not the province of this paper to deal with the origin and dissemination of the Christian religion. Suffice it to say that it is built around the person of Jesus of Nazareth, the humanly incarnate Michael son of Nebadon, known to Urantia as the Christ, the Anointed One. Christianity was spread throughout the Levant and Occident by the followers of this Galilean, and their missionary zeal equaled that of their illustrious predecessors, the Sethites, the Salamites, as well as their earnest Asiatic contemporaries, the Buddhist teachers.
Yeah, remember when they talked about how earnest those missionaries were? Again, notice that they're sort of telling you that they were foreshadowing that before. They want you to think a little bit more about the word Christ and kind of pull it out of this existing Christology, you know, and hence pull it out of all the Mithraic baggage and stuff, right? And it's a word that you don't have to toss out. It can be used again, like Christ Michael, okay? But if you're thinking Christology Christ, when you read Christ Michael in the book, you're in the old wineskin. right? And when all is said and done, it's, yeah, not really going to get you anywhere. It's not going to get you where you were hoping the book would get you. So you need to do this, like I was saying, with words like, see, I told you, see how they were kind of teasing that with reconcile? They're trying to get you to think in that mode. It's like, well, what could I do with the literalness of the word Christ, like I did with the literalness of the word reconcile? Now, see, they reminded you of the literalness, the anointed one? See? That's what they want you to do. Is there a way to think about that, that that's valid at a higher level? Instead of in the old sin sacrifice and atonement ghost cult wineskin, right, that Christology is in. That's what they're wanting you to do. All right.
The Christian religion as a Urantian system of belief arose through the compounding of the following teachings, influences, beliefs, cults, and personal individual attitudes. One, the Melchizedek teachings, which are a basic factor in all the religions of Occident and Orient that have arisen in the last 4,000 years.
Okay, so we're going to go through these sevenfold bullet points here. Some of them, you know, really bullet points, like these first two. So let's just remind ourselves a little bit. Yeah, we can drop back. Yeah, I'll read you a paragraph again. You know, if you drop back to the first of these papers in this Melchizedek block, paper 93 on Machiavelli and Melchizedek, and in section 3, there's a paragraph that kind of summarizes what they're referring to there. You know, the Melchizedek teachings as this basic factor. It says here, what is this, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6th paragraph in section 3 there. Melchizedek taught his followers all they had capacity to receive and assimilate. Even many modern religious ideas about heaven and earth, and of man, God, and angels, are not far removed from these teachings of Melchizedek. But this great teacher subordinated everything to the doctrine of one God, a universe deity, a heavenly creator, a divine father. Emphasis was placed upon this teaching for the purpose of appealing to man's adoration and of preparing the way for the subsequent appearance of Michael as the son of this same universal father. Okay, so when they're saying about this basic factor, we talked about extensively about one of those things, that we talked about trust and faith, you know, or just focus on the foundational element, faith. That's when, you know, all of a sudden that's sort of the really core thing that you're going to build all of Christianity on. And if Christianity starts to get way off in the weeds and, you know, and you're calling for coins to ring in coffers and so that souls can spring from eternity, Martin Luther can say, wait a minute. What did I say?
Eternity.
Oh, purgatory. Yeah. And so from purgatory springs. Yes. Sorry about that. You know, Martin Luther can step forward and say, wait a minute. We need to go back to the fundamentals. Let's go back to the fundamental, right? In item number one, sort of within item number one, faith. Not a whole bunch of external works, and certainly not coins ringing coffers relative to, you know, fanciful musings about purgatory. All right. Let's go back to basics. That's what Martin Luther was doing, going back to the core element in item number one. That's the Reformation. Right. But what else, you know, besides that faith predicate? Right, that, you know, fundamentally, that's what it's all based upon. Well, you've got monotheism, like they pointed out there. Yeah, so that's a foundational element. The whole bit of Most High, you know, like when they say a universe deity, a heavenly creator, right, like we talked about, you know, everyone's gods are basically down in the plane, right? In some way, lifting your thoughts up out of that plane of man to something above, you know, literally or figuratively above. And we talked about in all those evolutionary contexts with the Melchizedek missionaries, you know, a lot of times the literalness of the Sky Father being above, you know, coming from the Andites, it's like, well, you know, you could start there. It's kind of literal. He's above if he's the Sky Father. Now just encourage a little, more abstract thinking about that aboveness and his Most High being Most High. Right? So that aspect of elevating it out of the plane, monotheism, and the other key thing there, creatorship. Right? That was, you know, one of the very key things that Melchizedek, those missionaries were putting out there. And all these gods, you know, they're not really creator gods. You know, they're just the satisfiers of the material desires of a tribe. They're not creators. So that's another key element. So that's, you know, that's, you know, the essence of what they're wanting you to think about item number one there.
Yeah, I see that in the church today, that if they would hold fast to the concept of God as creator, that would eliminate a lot of the tomfoolery.
Mm-hmm.
But when that gets fuzzy, that God's a creator, all of their thinking gets fuzzy as well.
Yeah, right, it becomes very materialistic. You're never going to get to Jesus saying that he's your spiritual father, right? If he's your, you know, if he's a material technique, it's just, you know, you're not going to get very far. So, very important. All right, so that's the foundation. And then what do we add in with number two here?
Two, the Hebraic system of morality. Ethics, theology, and belief in both providence and the supreme Yahweh.
Okay, so you got those foundational elements from number one, and then you need to add in some sort of systemic complexity, right? I mean, a scheme that's been developed. You know, it's basically that Hebraic scheme that you're going to build in. In terms of morality, ethics, theology, right? And then, and of course, you know, between the lines there, when they say, and belief in both providence and the supreme Yahweh. So, providence, remember, that's what the Egyptians are contributing. Now, and of course, that capital P providence there is not the, you know, the genuine one in the Urantia book. That's the material technique providence. But, okay, it has some evolutionary positives. That's coming from the Egyptians, and then of course the whole Melchizedek engagement through, you know, of fostering prophets through all those centuries, so that you eventually can culminate in Second Isaiah with a supreme Yahweh, you know, far removed, far exalted, lifted up, you know, Most High from the volcano god. You know, but let's just remind ourselves, you know, the providence thing should immediately bring it to mind. When you're talking about morality, ethics, theology, etc., there, it all goes back to what you've got in paper 5, section 4, I turn to all the time, about the different beliefs about salvation, right? What does the Jewish religion promise? The Jewish religion promises salvation from difficulties. Prosperity predicated on righteousness. Okay. You can't remind yourself that enough. How much you are steeped in this very Judaic-biased material modality of prosperity predicated on righteousness. Yeah, and again, you go, well, wait a minute. There's a whole book in the Bible there to keep people from getting in that mode. And it's not even in the New Testament, it's the Old Testament, the book of Job. Okay? But just because the book of Job is in there, does that prevent Jews and Christians from going into the material, God is a material technique, prayer is a material technique, whatnot, sort of mode? No. Right? So if the Urantia book says it's not a sacred book, will that prevent it? No. This is the problem. It can be just literally in black and white in your sacred text that you shouldn't think of God like that, and everyone still does. It's so difficult to overcome, right, the frame, because it's sad to record that so few persons are reflecting. And it's only a person that reflects that can go, wait a minute, I'm in this frame. Huh. I mean, you don't even ever think about it. You go your entire life, right, die at 95, and it never occurs to you, right, that you've just adopted unwittingly all of these ancient pre-Old Testament assumptions, right, that you've crammed Jesus into, and you've crammed the Urantia book into, and it's just very sad to record. So you got to really challenge yourself to not let that mode, right? But if you go out of that mode, it's very unfamiliar territory. You're gonna be very confused to begin with. Remember, the papers we're about to read are going to talk about what kind of commotion is in your mind the moment you step out of the old wineskin. You've got to develop sea legs, because it's very discombobulating what happens to you when you go out of that old frame and have to think about God anew and prayer anew and everything anew. Right? Try to find Jesus that isn't Jesus as a material technique. I mean,
basically, tell us in the collective sense, we've stepped out of the safe harbor. Mm-hmm. We don't have the luxury of hanging out in that way. I mean, you can do it, but it's not going to be in sync with the collective anymore.
I mean, the fact that Jesus actually did some material techniques makes it all the more problematic to not think of him as nothing but a material technique. Right? He's a miracle guy. And that's all I care about. Very difficult. Right? To put the spiritual father first. Right? If you're going to think about a technique, think about a spiritual technique, not a material technique. What is prayer as a spiritual technique? Don't expect to go find some author that'll tell you. It's not written anywhere. It's unknown. I mean, we know prayer as a very effective psychologic procedure, and we know all about its superstitious belief as a material technique. Endless volumes written on both of those. But as a spiritual technique, that's a different matter. And how cool is that? That there's this completely uncharted territory that you could go in search of and discover its benefits for you. Wow, what is that? What is a spiritual technique? Why should I be interested in a spiritual father? Yeah. Okay, so those are the biggies. See, those two little bullet ones are just tiny little bullets, because they expect you to be able to write a whole volume on what items 1 and 2 really entail and how they're the basic foundation to Christianity. Okay, what are the little finesses that are thrown on top of it now?
3, the Zoroastrian conception of the struggle between cosmic good and evil, which had already left its imprint on both Judaism and Mithraism. Through prolonged contact attendant upon the struggles between Mithraism and Christianity, the doctrines of the Iranian prophet became a potent factor in determining the theologic and philosophic cast and structure of the dogmas, tenets, and cosmology of the Hellenized and Latinized versions of the teachings of Jesus.
Obviously, see, that's the big next thing that you add in, something that wasn't even there, right, in the oldest Judaism, wasn't dual spiritistic. You need to get the Christianity we know today, you've got to bring in dual spiritism in a very definitive way, right? And that's Zoroastrian. It's dual spiritism that's sophisticated enough to be laid on this Melchizedek Hebraic foundation we were just talking about. And you get all of the wonders of all that. Remember how much of that sort of battle in the end times stuff and whatnot, it was in Mithraism. See, it's because of the dual spiritism, Right? So you can just roll all that stuff over into Christianity. Right? You have heaven, you have a hell. Right?
The doctrine of the Iranian prophet became a potent factor in Christianity. Don't go over too well.
Honest people, you know, honest Christians like Martin Luther King Jr. knew how much Mithraism influenced Christianity. He knew full well, right?
It's interesting when we think of fundamentalist Christians. This is a lot of what we think. We're thinking of people who go back to this dual spiritism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, back to 1, 2, and 3, right? Right, the more fundamentalist, the more you're going back to, you know, maybe, like you said, and there's a place for that. Like I said, Martin Luther needed to go back to basics to get, you know, Christianity righted again, right? It was just getting way caught up in, you know, in temporal materialistic foolishness. It's like, wait, what about faith? What about grace? What about the basics? Yeah. What about that which is apart from the whole debt modality of evolutionary religion? I mean, he didn't fully realize all the consequences of what he was trying to focus on there, what an assault that is on the atonement doctrine, right? Anyway.
4, the mystery cults, especially Mithraism, but also the worship of the Great Mother in the Phrygian cult. Even the legends of the birth of Jesus on Urantia became tainted with the Roman version of the miraculous birth of the Iranian savior hero, Mithras, whose advent on earth was supposed to have been witnessed by only a handful of gift-bearing shepherds and who had been informed of the impending event by angels.
Right. So, let's think about that a little bit. It's like, well, okay. Right. I mean, you know, you go when you read that, you know, okay. I mean, you know, as a Urantia book student, you know, a couple things should come to mind. You know, they go, well, wait a minute. You know, when they say tainted. You know, about, you know, all this is like, no, wait a minute, weren't there 3 wise men really and stuff? It's like, okay, yeah. Yes, it is the case that certain wise men of earth knew of Michael's impending arrival. Through the contacts of one world with another, these wise men of spiritual insight learned of the forthcoming bestowal of Michael on Urantia. And the seraphim did, through the midway creatures, make announcement to a group of Chaldean priests whose leader was Ardnon. These men of God visited the newborn child in the manger. The only supernatural event associated with the birth of Jesus was this announcement to Ardnon and his associates by the seraphim of former attachment to Adam and Eve in the first garden, you know, the planetary helpers. Okay, so like that all actually happened. Okay, so, you know, what exactly is their issue here? I mean, you know, why are they saying there's all this tainting? It's like, well, okay, you got to go to the rest of the story. At the noontide birth of Jesus, the seraphim of Urantia assembled under their directors did sing anthems of glory over the Bethlehem manger, but these utterances of praise were not heard by human ears. No shepherds nor any other mortal creatures came to pay homage to the babe of Bethlehem until the day of the arrival of certain priests from Ur who were sent down from Jerusalem by Zacharias. Okay, so before I read the rest, remember, you know, here we have gift-bearing shepherds. Okay, so that's how the shepherds as well as the wise men get into the story. Okay. But what about the wise men? You know, that's the rest of it. These priests from Mesopotamia had been told some time before by a strange religious teacher of their country that he had a dream in which he was informed that the light of life was about to appear on earth as a babe and among the Jews. And of course, it's a quote unquote dream because they just told us it's actually midwares contacting and whatnot, mm-hmm. right? And thither went these three teachers looking for this light of life. After many weeks of futile search in Jerusalem, they were about to return to Ur when Zacharias met them and disclosed his belief that Jesus was the object of their quest and sent them on to Bethlehem, where they found the babe and left their gifts with Mary, his earth mother. And here's the key. The babe was almost 3 weeks old at the time of their visit. Right. So, but see, all of those historical factual details needed to be reworked because it needed to be the Mithras story, you know, just with Jesus replacing the name Mithras.
But factually, these wise men.
Same wise men.
Well, like I said, you know, you complexify it by having the shepherds come too, you know.
I mean, in the real story, in the when it was just read, you read about two different sets of wise men, right? One guy had the message, and the other.
I mean, remember, you've got what's going on actually in Chaldea,
right?
You know, with Ardman, you know, but then
there's
three people that go out, you know, inspired by that, you know, to go try to find this light of life.
Okay. Not
so you had this little community, this sort of, you know, eclectic community, right, that spawned those three, you know, seekers, right, to head over to Palestine.
Are they the same ones who went to Herod and Herod?
Yeah. Okay. Exactly. Right. There's only three that end up in Palestine.
Right? That's all.
Yeah, there's just one set of three, yeah, with all the you know, rigmarole with Herod and all that, yeah.
But 3 weeks, well, it's a long time still with travel in those days. They had to have left Chaldea. Well before the birth.
Yeah. Right. You know, see, again, because they were given precise timing, you know, and all this.
They didn't know exactly where they were going.
See, and they would have found him if they knew exactly where to go, right? I mean, you know, they were wandering around for a long time trying to find him, right? Right. So, the midwayers, you know, were giving some pretty specific stuff, you know. Just like Tenskwatawa knew exactly when the solar eclipse was or whatever, right? I mean, you know. Sometimes we're given very specific information when we're prophetized, you know, when we're literally engaged by celestial beings. But anyway, just, you know, so just to clear that up, taking that little diversion, you know, to just, you know, you read that, you're like, well, wait a minute, I don't think it was tainted. It's like, you know, all that stuff basically happened. It's like, no, just think about the details. And of course, I didn't read the next paragraph up there, you know, the whole Star of Bethlehem, you know, that's important, you know, to be able to lead them literally to where he is, you know, when he's, you know just a, you know, moments after he's born and whatnot. Right. So that whole scheme is to make it Mithraic, right? Mm-hmm. Right. The mythology is Mithraic. Mm-hmm. Right. And it just cleverly works in, you know, some of the actual facts. Yeah. And don't think of those people who wrote those stories as being deceitful. Right? They're not. There's no notion of being a historian that they're rejecting, you know, and trying to deceive you, you know, and creating a false history. They're not. That's not their agenda to be historians. Their agenda is to basically try to give you the truth of what went on. And they're not thinking post-Enlightenment factually. No one has that kind of relationship to facts, right? Until after the Enlightenment, basically. Like, you know, like you were born into. So they're not being deceitful. They're just trying to give you the essence of what's important for you to know about. And they captured that. All right. See, and again, that just kind of reminds me, it should remind you of what we did with the word reconcile, right? Don't just, you know, be a truth seeker first, not a fact finder. You know, so that you get all wrapped around the axle all the time. You can get the facts, but get to them from the top down.
Right? We get the fact in this next one right here.
Yeah, like I said, see? And here we go again. This is the key thing I was talking about with Christ.
5, the historic fact of the human life of Joshua ben Joseph, the reality of Jesus of Nazareth as the glorified Christ, the Son of God.
Okay. Yeah, well, wait a minute. Isn't that just Christology? Jesus is a glorified Christ? No. The reality. There's a reality there. You can use the word Christ. You can talk about the anointed one. Okay, but just think about it in less simplistic ghost cult sort of modality, right? An incarnate Son of God, right? That genuine man, Jesus the man, I mean, is he not anointed by being incarnated? You have poured something upon him, have you not? Poured it within him, right? I mean, you know, there's a truth to him as the Christ, as the anointed. It's not in the, you know, in the Hebraic messianic sense or something, right? Where you're literally pouring oil on someone's head. No, but there's a reality that you can abstract, that you can draw from the mishmash of the ghost cult framework. That's what they want you to do, to give you an on-ramp. Maybe you're an exceptional individual and don't need little on-ramp helps like that, but most likely you do. And so take their suggestions. I mean, they do it all over when they talk about Jesus, right? I mean, you know, especially, you know, in the latter papers when they're sort of kind of processing his life for you and saying, well, you know, you've always, in Christology, you've always thought about it like this, but you don't have to be in that mode. You can basically think like that, you know, how he's a savior and whatnot, but not in the simplistic sin, sacrifice, and atonement way, right? See a reality there that you haven't seen before. And you can get to the reality if you approach it top down through truth. There's a truth that's flowing through those thoughts, despite the ignorance of the authors of the thoughts. By grace, we aren't divorced totally from truth. So you can find truth in very mysterious places because of grace.
Six, the personal viewpoint of Paul of Tarsus. And it should be recorded that Mithraism was the dominant religion of Tarsus during his adolescence. Paul little dreamed that his well-intentioned letters to his converts would someday be regarded by still later Christians as the, quote, Word of God, unquote. Such well-meaning teachers must not be held accountable for the use made of their writings by later day successors.
Yeah, don't be so hard on Paul. Come on. You know, and look at, see that coincidentally, they're telling you, right, you know, if you think about this as some sort of perverted corruption of Jesus' teachings, it's like, look at this vast evolutionary conspiracy. Coincidentally, what was the dominant religion of Tarsus during Paul's adolescence? This is just the way it was going to roll out. I mean, it's just, it's the process that needed to play out. But it's now a time, that's when, you know, the book is here, you can only take that so far. And it's time at least for a few to get out of the old wineskins, right? And find Jesus apart from Mithras, for instance. And then maybe actually through that separated real Jesus, through him find God, the real God, instead of the ghost cult God, right, that Mithras was playing with, right, the real God.
Seven, the philosophic thought of the Hellenistic peoples. From Alexandria and Antioch through Greece to Syracuse and Rome, the philosophy of the Greeks was more in harmony with Paul's version of Christianity than with any other current religious system, and became an important factor in the success of Christianity in the Occident. Greek philosophy, coupled with Paul's theology, still forms the basis of European ethics.
Yeah, so that's the finishing touch. It's so important to give this evolutionary religious effort a little bit of a measure of truthizing, if you will, you know, of putting into a philosophic frame. Right, so it isn't just this thing apart like it was with the Hebrews. You know, it sort of, you know, that you stumble into bringing a little bit more truth to that effort, and it's again, you know, part of the reason why it's not Christianism but Christianity. See, because of that logic frame, that Greek derived logic frame, Christology, right? Christology. As you're trying to, you know, to incorporate. So, you know, and of course the geography there, you know, if you know, can't visualize that, you know, start down in Egypt. Let me do it this way for you. You start down in Egypt to Alexandria and just, you know, wrap around the Mediterranean, right? You wrap up like this, you're at Antioch, you know, you go through Greece and you get over to Syracuse and Sicily and go up to Rome. Right, in other words, just going all the way around there, that, the whole, you know, Levant and beyond, if you will, right now, gets assimilated into the final Christian product.
Yeah, when you go forward to the Enlightenment, initially, those thinkers during the Enlightenment were Christian.
Mm-hmm.
They were grounded in their Christian faith.
Right. Yeah.
But they drew on the Greek philosophy,
it allows. See, you spark yourself with some genuine religion, even if it's, you know, kind of third, fourth hand or whatever. You attempt to put it in a philosophic frame. You know, you attempt to get a little bit more top down, and see, you can go from the philosophy down to the science. Right, and you can begin to develop a genuine science in the Enlightenment. I mean, that finding that science is predicated on the on what Jesus did in the first century. You know, and no matter how much it got muddled through the Middle Ages and whatnot, it comes out the other side, you know, with a born again 3-century process of the Reformation or the Renaissance. Excuse me, not the Reformation, but the Renaissance. Right, that born again process. See, sort of born again to a spark. Right? Even if you think you're trying to get away from the ecclesiastical stuff, you've taken a hold of that spark, that religious spark nucleus, and it gives you something to wrap a more truthful sphere of philosophy around, and then within which you can begin to find science. You know, and you could have reworked religion too, but before we went on, we got to the beginning of the 20th century, and then it all just starts to evaporate because we think, oh, this whole frame, this philosophic frame, was just delusional. There really is no such thing as a genuineness to philosophy. That's just opinion. Oh yeah, and by the way, the thing that technically, we were building that around, you know, that's just superstition, that religion stuff. All you need is science. It's like, well, the instant you take science out of its philosophic frame and without its complement of some sort of rudimentary religion, science is going to just go off into la-la land like it has during, you know, during the 20th century and into the 21st. Right. It's all undarkened again. All right, so...
Ergo,
all sorts of dark things in so-called science. But just, you know, notice the irony there that, when they said the philosophy of the Greeks was more in harmony with Paul's version of Christianity than any other current religious system, even though Paul himself, you know, said we preach Christ crucified, foolishness, right, to the Greeks. But despite that, if you're clever enough, you can bring in the wisdom of the Greeks, right? You know, juxtaposed with the foolishness of the atonement doctrine, you know, and go forward with something that's better than nothing. So that's how you get Christianity. It's quite the polyglot construct, is it not? Right. There's never been something this complicated. See, it is the fruits of a million years of that complexifying evolutionary religion. You've sort of reached the limits of how many levels you can stack the card house up. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just... Right. So it's time. Don't try to stack another level on that card house. Right. Let's start anew. Okay, so again, a couple paragraphs to wrap us up here.
As the original teachings of Jesus penetrated the Occident, they became Occidentalized. And as they became Occidentalized, they began to lose their potentially universal appeal to all races and kinds of men. Christianity today has become a religion well adapted to the social, economic, and political mores of the white races. It has long since ceased to be the religion of Jesus, although it still valiantly portrays a beautiful religion about Jesus to such individuals as sincerely seek to follow in the way of its teaching. It has glorified Jesus as the Christ, the messianic anointed one from God, but has largely forgotten the Master's personal gospel, the fatherhood of God, and the universal brotherhood of all men.
Okay, two little elements there, just to highlight for you. I mean, the irony of Jesus so consciously trying to be just a spiritual uplifter and setting aside all social, economic, and political issues. All said and done, what is it? It's not religion. It's social, economic, and political mores. Right. So just the opposite of what he attempted to do. And because of that, you know, it can't be the dispensational, the universalizable religion that it, a revelation that it was supposed to be. Right? A dispensational revelation is, you know, is meant to engage everyone. Well, Occidentalized social, economic, and political moray scheme. It's not, right? There's no way it can be a dispensational revelation, a universalizable revelation. And then, of course, like, you know, I was trying to point out, remember, this is not a dispensational revelation. It's got all these things we've been talking about all night long. An awful lot of it is not at all able to be put out to everyone, right? And is really for that parallel stream. It could bring you into a phenomenon where you could go, not take it, but take yourself as a cosmic conscious individual into the main evolutionary stream and be a leader. Yeah, could definitely do that. But. Okay, then the other thing is, notice the capital F on fatherhood of God. Capital F fatherhood, right, is something that they only do outside of part four. You know, it's lowercase f, fatherhood, everywhere in part four, you know, and a couple of other places outside too. But capital F father is only apart from part four. Because it's only apart from part four that they're trying to encourage you to go from God to deity. Right? Capitalizing the F on fatherhood, instead of thinking just of God as your father, right, but you know, set the personalization part aside and just think of the deity, the Father, instead of God the Father. Right? And that deityhood, that particular flavor of deityhood, capital F fatherhood, that's something that they, you know, subtly put in there, you know, in the earlier parts of the book, so that eventually you can come around and seek that, right? And when all is said and done, you can go to the last sentence and notice that it doesn't say universal father idea. It says the father idea, the deity idea, right? Rather than the individual God idea. Right? But see, that's for the advanced student of the fifth epical revelation. But it's definitely there, very, very purposely, not using capital F fatherhood in part four. Okay, and... then here's you know, big paragraph break, because giant paragraph break, because this is the footnote for the whole block of papers that we've been going through.
And this is the long story of the teachings of Machaventa Melchizedek on Urantia. It is nearly 4,000 years since this emergency son of Nabadon bestowed himself on Urantia, and in that time the teachings of the, quote, priest of El Elyon, the Most High God, unquote, have penetrated to all races and peoples. And Machaventa was successful in achieving the purpose of his unusual bestowal. When Michael made ready to appear on Urantia, the God concept was existent in the hearts of men and women, the same God concept that still flames anew in the living spiritual experience of the manifold children of the Universal Father as they live their intriguing temporal lives on the whirling planets of space. Presented by Melchizedek of Nebadon.
It can flame anew if there's something to you besides that which is caught up in an intriguing temporal life on a whirling planet of space. You know, as they very purposely put it in that. Because that vortex, right, you can easily get caught up in all that, right, and never find an inner life apart from that whirling outer life. But it's there. See, I mean, they're reminding you that despite all that, despite about how you can get sucked into that outer life vortex so easily, get all caught up in social justice and whatnot, you have the potential to do what Jesus said you could do, right, and find a genuine inner life and begin everything anew. Plant your feet in eternity, free your hands to work in that outer life, instead of standing in that whirling outer life of quicksand and desperately grasping with your hands, trying to hold on to eternity and not succeeding very well. Because the minute you grab it, the whirl rips your grip. Right? You have to flip it around. You have to stand in eternity, the changeless, eternal fact. Right? Stand unmoved there. And then free your hands to serve in time.
So in reality, do you stand there?
In reality, you do.
You do, right. So you don't have to make it up.
It's not that you have to make up. It was your feet were planted there super consciously, as it were, by grace. Just discover right. Where your real feet are. It appears your feet are here. Not really. Your real feet are planted in eternity. Find your real feet. These are just your temporal actual feet. Find your real feet. You know, it's important to find your feet. Because remember when we went through biologic evolution, you had all these different creatures were a certain kind of foot, like a brachiopod, a cephalopod, right?
Yeah.
It's right there. That's the whole point, is to find your foot, right? And you're a human. So unlike all those such-and-so pods, right? You have a foot that's planted in eternity. Find that foot and stand on it. That's you know how you can go. You know, we've gone through all of this evolution, see now, through the biologic evolution and everything, social evolution and whatnot. Okay, now we're ready to start talking about eternity and having it as a predicate.
Does that make us a tripod?
That's it. Run with that as you wish, but nonetheless, see that's the key, and that's what sets the stage for moving into paper 99, as we will do next week. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.